Well, I leave this theory to you. It's a pleasure to be here. I normally hang out with a different gang. You call them experimentalists, I suppose. So the title is Bosonic String Formation in QCD. Those are my collaborators. This has been a long, long dragged out project, and I can only give you a bird's eye view of what we have been trying to do. I do work with two string theorists. James Drummond helped me to work out corrections in Joe's model, which I will mention and describe. And I have a local string counselor whom I enjoy a lot, and he usually straightens me out. There's an early history of this topic, which I'm going to skip. And I mainly will show you results from a series of relatively recent publications by our group in various combinations, and also a series of papers of Lüscher and Weiss. I will try to show you that you can actually determine how the string is being formed in QCD. And basically, you have two methods. If you are holding a violin string, but you don't see it in your hands, you have two choices to verify that you have a violin string. There is a kind of a mundane but sophisticated, nevertheless, way of doing it, that you use some, force meter, and you measure the force extremely accurately. And when you detect the contribution of the Casimir force, you say, aha, I have a string. Now, that's a tall order. That's what Lüscher and Weiss try to do. But we prefer to play the violin, so you want to see the spectrum and listen to it, whether you have a string or not. And I will briefly mention something which I kind of decided to call a Casimir energy paradox. I don't want to put a lot of emphasis on this feature of the spectrum, but I will leave to you some of the interpretation. So the outline, first I will try to describe to you what we expect about string formation in space and time. And I will show you some modest but real strings, what they do, and try to identify the main physical properties and ask questions. Some of it will be answered during the talk, some of it won't. Then I will analyze QCD, what we know about QCD, both in 3 and 4 dimension, and with two gauge groups, SU2 and SU3. It's pure glue. So if you want to put back fermions, it's a very interesting topic for the afternoon discussion. Then as a pedagogical tool, and try to connect with the underlying physics, which you cannot penetrate as deeply as we would like to, I will use a toy model, a very interesting toy model, Z2 gauge in 2+1 dimension, to re-emphasize all the points which we addressed in QCD. I am going to leave this for private or panel discussions. There's a very interesting lesson to learn from 1+1 dimensional models, but I won't have time to talk about this. So the question is that if you have confinement, what is this stuff connecting? Now, obviously, when you see a wiggly line like this, it cannot be, you know, what you normally call the flux tube. Maybe it is an underlying microscopic loop variable which you want to somehow develop as a theory. But there is some stuff here, and we know that it's confining. So we have a linearly growing potential and a constant force. So we can try to determine the Casimir energy. We can try to determine the excitation spectrum. The first thing we want to verify, if we are on the wave for string formation, is whether we have so-called Goldstone modes, which correspond to massless excitations of whatever object you have in between. Then, of course, the next one would be to verify that the Goldstone modes interact via an effective interaction, which can be described by a local derivative type expansion. Then, if you have that, you want to see whether this can come from a string theory, whether the string will reproduce this kind of behavior. And then things get loose here, and I'm not going to go into it. You know, the old dreams, that you find some very clever way of producing microscopic string theory-based variables, either loop equations, or you go in your favorite number of dimensions, etc. I'm not going to talk about that, because this is going to be mainly experimental. You know, I am the experimentalist who knows a little bit about theory, but not about string theory a whole lot. And the ultimate question is, of course, do we have a geometric interpretation? As I said, I will work on the lattice. It is an on-lattice QCD spectrum. And the toy model is also a lattice version, although this can be done, and I did it, also in continuum notation. Maybe just a note about the Z2 model, which I will use. It's interesting because, as far as I know, that was the first model where Polyakov introduced more than 20 years ago the notion that you can reformulate Z2 gauge in terms of loop equations, and he had a dream that he will solve it and apply it to critical indices of the 3D easing model, etc. So this was, you know, interesting on its own. So as I said, our main questions are, do we have massless Goldstone modes developing? Do we have a local derivative expansion? How can we find it from the fine structure of the spectrum? Do we have massive excitations of that string? You know, usually when you look at the string from the theoretical viewpoint, you tend to set aside the question that this string can have very interesting physical properties. And if you establish them, it is up to you to provide your microscopic theory which accounts for it. So in other words, if we have massive excitations on that string, you better keep that in mind when you are pulling out your magic models and you try to explain the spectrum. Of course, those massive excitations would imply breathing modes of the effective Lagrangian, which are massive, and then ultimately we want string properties. Is it bosonic? Is it Nambu-Goto-like? Do we have signs for rigidity, etc.? So first I thought I would show you actually what you see in the computer. So that's a very simple string model, the Z2 model in three dimensions. And I have down there a quark and an antiquark very close to each other with a separation of much less of a Fermi. I just set the scale by the string tension and put in there what we have in QCD. So you set the scale, you can talk about Fermis, it doesn't matter. But the two quarks are definitely very close. It's more like a dipole-type bag, a dipole-type field inside, and that's the object you see. And you can do it in real time. Now, that's not cheating. The reason you can do this in real time, I could make movies and it might be modestly enjoyable, because you can get the wave functions of the exact stationary states of the low-lying levels. You have the string profile, which is the vacuum profile of the string. So therefore, you can run it in real time just from the energy eigenvalues, putting in the exponential phases. So it is interesting that if you are able to determine the spectrum, you can actually see what this damn thing does in real time. Now, this thing which I showed you, remember, was two quarks very close. Now you pull them apart. Oh, it is only because there's a misplacement of the patching up the figures. So when you pull it apart, that's about 4 Fermi, then you actually see something developing. Ah, this is your flux tube, right? And then you have all the eigenfunctions, so you can actually run it. That's what it does. That is n equals 3, massless, so that's your Goldstone mode. Just because you have a Goldstone mode, if you didn't see this underlying picture, you would not be allowed to think that those are interacting via a local derivative expansion, because in the spectrum you only measure that you have Goldstone modes. But of course in a movie, which I cannot make unfortunately in QCD before Bob Sugar completely succeeds with the SIDEC project, Nevertheless, in Z2, you have a glimpse of what is coming on Lattice in QCD soon, I hope. Now, that was the Goldstone modes developing. But when you look at the spectrum, when the two quarks are closed, the quark and the antiquark, you say, hey, I found another excitation. You just see it when you get the spectrum. So you look at the time dependence of this other excitation, and that's what it is. It's a pulsating thing when the quark and the antiquark are very close. Now you pull that apart. That's what you get when you pull it apart. That's a snapshot of this adiabatically developing mode. And the separation is big. You know, in the Z2 lattice, you have the luxury. I'm not going to give you any lattice details, just like you're not giving me quite often theory details. So that is the snapshot. And that's what this damn thing does. And that's a breathing mode of that string, which has visit associated a full massive string spectrum. So we know that the Z2 string has Goldstone modes. Associated with it, you have what you would normally call your objective of describing from string theory. In addition, it has a massive part in the spectrum, which has to do with the fact that the Z2 string is rigid or anti-rigid, depending on your convention of design. And that anti-rigidity implies this breathing mode, or vice versa. And when you develop a theory, you better account for it.
Is this the lowest massive mode?
What I was showing you was actually the second massive mode. But you tell me what energy level you want, and I will describe it to you. That was the second massive excitation. So back to the outline to be on track. So I gave you the picture. I mentioned the physical properties we are after, and now onto QCD. So the objective is a blind test. You place down the quark and the antiquark, that you can pull them apart, you can vary the distance, and you are asking yourself the most general question you can ask. What is the glue excitation spectrum without any prejudice whatsoever surrounding the quark-antiquark pair? That gluon field can be excited around this axis, and it is characterized by three exact quantum numbers. The chirality of the gluon field projected along the molecular axis, the chirality of reflection symmetry when the projection is zero for the angular momentum along the axis, just like in a molecule. And then you have the CP quantum number, which is also exact, where G will stand in my notation for even CP for the whole object, including the gluon field, Gerade in German. That's the old spectroscopic notation of Wigner. Just shows my nationalistic bias. And then U for Ungerade, which is the CP odd. And I will label the states according to the conventional molecular spectroscopy notation. Sigma is lambda equals 0, pi is 1, delta 2, etc. Then you have the Gerade, Ungerade only for the lambda equals 0 modes is relevant, because for the other modes where lambda is different from 0, it is enough to specify the chirality. So those are the quantum numbers. Now you have to catch them on the lattice. So how do you do that? Well, you normally, when you work with your ADS theories and you are showing me your glue ball spectrum and the rest, you work with Wilson lines or Wilson surfaces, which normally you calculate using straight lines. Now that's not enough here, because you have to capture all the gluon excitations. So what you do is that you introduce in the spatial part of the lattice, complicated operators, Wigley operators, which in appropriate combinations can project out the appropriate continuum quantum numbers. With a very few exceptions, you can use enough operators that you can resolve every quantum number. There are a few remaining cases, and if you work hard on it, you could resolve those too, but you would need more and more operators. Typically, we work here with of the order of 20 to 40 operators, and because you run in time, where you just run in straight, then you have a pretty big correlation matrix to analyze, and with a proper analysis, you can determine from it the spectrum. And of course, if you look at the overlaps, you can also determine the, in potentially, you can determine the wave functions. But the QCD accuracy is not good enough at the moment that we could say a whole deal about the space-time distribution. Now, this is the spectrum you get. That's a remarkable spectrum, actually. I'm only showing you about 12 energy levels. So let me try to explain to you what you are seeing. Here you are pulling the quark-antiquark pair, and here you are going out to about 3 Fermi. We have data beyond that. We have data up to about 4 Fermi from very small separation, say from 0.1 Fermi, and we are following the spectrum as you are pulling. Now, the energy levels are labeled as I described them to you, and you will find the details on the web page, of course. It's an unfamiliar notation to you, and I wish I could help more. But the color is you want to focus on. So this is the ground state. That's your good old ground state, straight like an arrow. Now you wonder, how can you see the Casimir energy in a straight line like an arrow? I will show you how. And then the color coding is supposed to color the ordering of the string states, the expected string states, if you pull long enough. So red would be n equals 1, green would be n equals 2, etc. And of course, you have composite excitations, which your correlation matrix also picks up, because you can doubly excite a mode, or you can occupy one mode twice, etc. So you have a complex spectrum. And of course, according to the color coding, you expect that you will eventually develop a string-like ordering. Now, of course, at short distances, where everybody tried to prove that you have a string, it's not a string. I mean, the color object should be degenerate at short distances, but look at sigma u minus and look at those, you know, in this region below 1 Fermi. They're not string-like. Now, so then you wonder, what are they then? It's not too difficult to figure out what you are seeing, because if you develop a simple but powerful model for the short distance description, you have the quark and the antiquark. They are close, so it is a color multipole. And you excite the gluon in this color multipole. Now, this can be described by a Coulomb-type Hamiltonian in Coulomb gauge, and then you can analyze what you expect. And of course, what you expect is that in this multipole expansion, the leading terms, when you are close, the quark and the antiquark, will show another kind of degeneracy, which roughly speaking will be the degeneracy of a gluon which you bust into the confining region, which is a totally different type of degeneracy. And that's exactly what you are seeing in the data. So at short distances, you see basically short distance QCD, the fingerprint of short distance QCD. Then you pull, and when you pull, of course, you get into a gigantic mass which nobody really knows how to describe, because violently the system begins to develop something which is flux tube-like, and the wrong levels are violently rearranging and seeking each other out and join happily according to string degeneracies. So the string is on the way, with one caveat. Now, of course, it is string-like, the ordering, but even here on this summary figure, you see fine structure. And you don't know a priori how those levels compare with the asymptotic Nambu-Goto-type expectation. But for a first look, you would say, well, it looks like we are developing a Nambu-Goto-like string. Yes, I know, Nambu-Goto is. In most of the cases, they are, yes. So the results are very accurate.
And this is a non-dynamical calculation.
Yes, this is the non-dynamical calculation. And in fact, you know, when you are out to three Fermi or four, and if you have dynamical fermions and if they were light, this damn thing would probably split. So no, this is just your beloved large N quenched, whatever you call it. Yes? This, you mean this one, the red one? The black one is the ground state. No, when you go, you notice that, you know, I just cut out that part of the figure. When you drop below, you will see, wait for the next figure, you will see it. You will match asymptotic freedom beautifully. And then when you pull, you begin to see, according to Mr. Lüscher anyway, that you are detecting the Casimir force in addition. That's a new technology which was not feasible, say, before, you know, new meaning the last 2 years. You can do extremely accurate measurement of the ground state to about 10 to the minus 6 accuracy. So then I would really have a hard time plotting error bars. Extremely accurate, using very nice tricks. So that's where we stand. And now Mr. Lüscher comes into the picture and says, let us measure the Casimir energy. So what I'm plotting here looks very complicated, but it really isn't. I'm plotting calculations with the SU3 gauge group in D equals 3 and 4, where Mr. Lüscher would isolate the Casimir term by calculating the first derivative of the force. That's the second derivative of the potential. Now, of course, this first derivative of the force, according to appropriate normalization, if it is a string, should show a non-vanishing quantity asymptotically, and it should be related to the conformal charge describing the massless Goldstone modes interacting through a local effective Lagrangian. That's an indirect way of testing the violin string. Now, of course, this was tremendously controversial, and the lattice guys just were all over the place claiming that you saw Casimir behavior in a regime where you were not supposed to, etc. But with the new technique, it's very accurate. And what you see here, for example, in four dimension, this is what you get with error bars for predictions, say, from the running Coulomb law in QCD. That's what I meant by the match. So the error bars are opening up because actually, when you try to measure the running coupling constant at a separation which is not that short, then you begin to develop obvious, you know, one loop, two loop, three loop. You are going to break down, but it's a match. And then suddenly there is a crossover around 0.5 Fermi into what you would identify as the Casimir charge dug up from this highly accurate data. So that's very interesting and very puzzling, because before we lose our sanity, this is where they are seeing this. So that's what I dubbed as a paradox, as you know, unless somebody really provides me with a very good theory, there is a kind of a paradoxical situation. Why on earth? You know, Lüscher, of course, believes that. Remember this Pierre Ramon joke where God was handing down to Adam in the Sistine Chapel the string, you know, looping around his fingertip, that maybe this is God's, you know, loop. I don't think so. So I think it's a fluke, but you cannot exclude it that there is something deep here. This early, precocious, very precocious onset of the Casimir behavior. So about the Casimir, I don't want to bore with you the details because I would get carried away, but I just want to mention it's rather surprising and interesting. And when I had to sum n from 1 to infinity, divide by 2 and get minus pi over 24, I knew I was not smart enough for string theory. But this is not a paradox, that's easy. But as an experimentalist, the way I do it is that I do it on the lattice, so I take a 1 plus 1 dimensional Dirichlet string theory, I calculate this, I will have cutoff dependent terms, divergent, of course, when a goes to 0, and there's a beautiful finite piece, which is your Casimir term, say for a Dirichlet field in 1 plus 1 dimension, so I understand that. So I thought, I can do string theory. No, but I cannot, because what we really have is that when you sum n from 1 to 3 and divide by half, we still get minus pi over 24, and that's too difficult for me. So hopefully we will have some discussion or shed some light on this, whether this can be understood. Now this is a paradox, to me anyway. Now, of course, you can wonder that the end effects are confusing things here. You know, in a string theory, to you, the end is just a mathematical point. You associate boundary operators with it. You don't have any special treatment for the endpoints. But in field theory, you know, its life is more complicated and messy. So we don't know what the end effects are. So at that point, we began to look into the string soliton, which doesn't have any end. So we looked at a string soliton with one unit of winding and get the spectrum. Very similar things happen again. So at short distances, you have a fine structure which substantially deviates from expected Nambu-Goto-like behavior. And you pull, you still see a fine structure, but the ordering becomes more and more string-like. That's what you find. I just wanted to flash for you some of those spectra, and you see a fine structure, but you see the main organization is similar. And I have to confess that we have not analyzed the what we call a torelon, which is a lattice jargon, not only lattice actually. So you would call it a string soliton with unit winding, but there's a ton of information there, and I don't believe that the conclusions are very different. And I think the dilemma remains. I also should add that Mr. Lüscher's technology is not applicable yet to the closed string, so we don't know what happens to the Casimir energy in this case. So that is an ongoing issue or research topic. So those are the spectra. I apologize for breezing through, but I want to have a sanity check now about this objective which we had early. So what is the first sanity check? Do we have massless Goldstone modes? Very likely we do. It would be a fantastic accident to see this kind of incredible level ordering as you go from short to large distance. So we are developing the Goldstone modes. Now, do we see a fine structure? Yes, we see a fine structure. The fine structure, remember, is the fingerprint and the window into the local derivative effective Lagrangian. Almost everybody's favorite topic, or one of the favorite topics. Do we have enough now, right now in QCD that we could nail down what this effective Lagrangian is? No, we don't. That remains under question mark. And we know nothing about the massive excitations. And we also don't feel confident that we can predict what kind of a string is being developed. For example, we don't know about the rigidity term. And therefore, to go back and understand more deeply what it would take to have the next push, we go back to Z2 in three dimension and go through the exercise there. So once we learn there how to do this right, then we feel at least we can estimate what it would take to do the same in QCD to eliminate those question marks or replace them with check marks or something else. So in our schedule check, Bill, how much time do I have? Okay, great. So now back to Z2, and which is a string in 2+1 dimension. Again, I want to discuss the same topics in Z2, the spectrum, the Casimir energy, do we have a paradox, the closed string spectrum, and compare with our notion of a string theory description. The analogy with QCD is actually quite remarkable. Let me just refresh your memory what the three-dimensional Z2 gauge theory is. It's a continuum field theory. It has a non-trivial fixed point. So it's a highly non-trivial, non-interacting quantum field theory. It has, we expect that it has a confinement phase in which we should see a developing string with all its excitations. We have a global spectrum in this theory, and we can ask almost all the questions which we like to ask in QCD. But it has one fantastic advantage from the lattice technology viewpoint. that as you recall, Z2 gauge in three dimension is dual to the spin representation, which is the good old 3D easing model. So therefore, when you do your calculations, I will come back to that, then you simply have to transform the Wilson lines, however complicated they are, into the easing representation, which will appear to you for a straight line as a flip of seams, you know, along the line in the dual lattice. And then, of course, you have to throw at it all your operators and the rest. But the advantage is that you can actually do multi-spin coding in the easing representation. So, you know, it becomes parallel square because you have 64 bits parallel in a single CPU, and then you can run it parallel. So it's incredibly efficient and fast. So you can really go for the killing if you do Z2. So those are the advantages. Now that's a long list of excuses for doing it because it is doable. Now let me go to this picture. That's a very important summary sheet or slide indicating to you what you expect. So that is the dual transformation where, you know, beta is the easing coupling constant, 1 over g squared. Beta bar is the gauge coupling constant. That's the well-known dual relation. And in terms of our QCD language, it's a very funny model that it has a critical point, and in this yellow region where the symmetry is broken in the easing case, meaning a disorder in the gauge case, which is what we want, that's confinement, that yellow region corresponds to the what we would call the continuum limit of QCD in the Stoy analogy. It has also a deconfined phase here for larger beta couplings, meaning weaker gauge coupling. That's none of our concern. But interestingly, it also has a roughening transition. So the Wilson surface in the Z2 model undergoes a transition which is probably there also in QCD, but astonishingly enough, it was a cottage industry in the 80s. People studied the roughening to death, but some of the deaths didn't come because when I look back and read those papers, you get nothing out of it, really. So in other words, in Z2 we know with confidence what happens. You take a Wilson surface and you go to very strong coupling. That surface has a gap in the excitation spectrum. So the surface, in the jargon of condensed matter physics, is smooth. At the roughening point, that gap vanishes. It vanishes as a Kösterli-Stawless phase transition, so it undergoes a very fancy phase change. And from the roughening point on, the Wilson surface is massless down to the critical point, including the critical region. So this Wilson surface does something truly remarkable. It is gapless everywhere, but when it is gapless here, it is embedded into a terrible hypercubic shape lattice. But somehow it preserves its conformal properties. Of course, the conform violation comes from added operators, which are cutoff dependent, but the spectrum is gapless. So what happens is, and we know the critically, we know the university class of that spectrum. It is the Gaussian, plain, old, boring theory. So I have a string theory here. It is the Gaussian model for that Wilson surface. But as we go from here to here, we recover the true string. So there has to be a crossover in universality behavior from the Gaussian into what we all want and what we don't quite know fully. And that crossover is key to understanding Z2, and it would be also key to understand QCD if we would know for sure that the Wilson surface undergoes this kind of roughening transition in QCD too. So it's a fantastic exercise, you know, in your mind to think about what a Wilson surface does as you vary the gauge coupling from strong to weak.
But the same thing is you vary the area?
Pardon me? It's always area in that phase, and when you look at the excitation spectrum of the surface, it is gapless in this phase, and it has a gap here. Yeah. everywhere. But of course, you see in the spectrum the irrelevant operators of the underlying conformal field theory, because at finite cutoff. So strictly speaking, because you don't have a scale, A is your only scale. So when you look at things as a function of L, you see some violations of the Goldstone mode, but you can describe precisely what those violations are. So they are under good control here. Then you run into this crossover region where nobody knows what's going on, and suddenly here your beautiful swan made a transformation into something which nobody understands. Maybe that's part of the beauty, as David pointed out. Now, the methodology is very easy. I can play here theorist and experimentalist to death. So the theorist would go through the what you used to call soliton quantization, right? Because you put in the quark and the antiquark, you introduce the seam connecting them. In the dual representation, it is described by quantum field theory, actually. And you can do a loop expansion on this quantum field theory. So you have a soliton potential. And then you can solve the excitation spectrum in this potential. And then you let it interact and see what happens due to the interactions. But the first thing you want is the spectrum in this effective Schrödinger equation. What goes into the second what goes into the effective Schrödinger equation is the second derivative of the field at the soliton profile. And this is the order parameter as you calculate, say, from mean field theory. And therefore, we understand how the string should develop here. The way it should develop is that we have this long potential which is trapping excitation. Now, we know that there must be something special guaranteeing the Goldstone mode. But we know what it is, because a soliton, every bit of that thing which we excite, can move freely in the transfer direction. That doesn't cost energy. But when you do them in synchronous fashion from bit to bit as you move along, that just adds up to a plane wave. So roughly, the solutions will have that form. This is my z direction. That's my x direction in my other life. For some reason, and I apologize for it, y is my time direction. So that's how you expect the Goldstone modes to develop. But of course, they will have n distortions. Now here you see the order parameter profile in mean field. That's what you get in Monte Carlo simulation. And note that the separation here is 100. So you can really do a lot of damage to this theory. Doing the Monte Carlo, or in fact doing this theory, you have two quantum numbers, which are the reflections in the two directions in a given plane. Now that's how a bag-like excitation looks like. So what you are seeing is the wave function as you capture it in the Monte Carlo simulation at lattice spacing of 0.04 Fermi. So the separation between the quark and the antiquark here is 0.4 Fermi. So that's not string-like. That's the little bag I was showing you doing its flip-flop. Terrible memories, isn't it? So that's that will develop or evolve into the massless modes. But there was also the other stuff, which is the breathing mode, which will develop into the massive one. I will mainly talk about the massless modes just to show off. That's the eighth excitation of that string at a separation of 100. And that's the wave function you get from the simulation. That's a pretty picture. And then, of course, you can play the movie with it because you know the time evolution. So you really have an oscillating string here, no doubt about it. And you are seeing it for the first time. Now, this is the comparison with theory. Ignore the scale because the simulation wave functions are not normalized to 1. That's the only change because the operators are not normalized to 1. Now, you are throwing in operators, you rarely normalize them to 1, right, in your overlaps of the physical states. So we have the Goldstone mode. So why do we have a derivative expansion? In the field theory language, it is easy to understand. You rewrite your theory in terms of collective variables. Follow the advice of Joe Polchinski and Strominger and some others that pay attention to the Jacobian when you are doing this. Then you develop a new set of Feynman diagrams where you have the massless Goldstone modes. They can exchange the massive excitations of this theory, which you would call glue balls in your jargon. And when the scale is appropriate, the loops will shrink into a derivative expansion, so you can generate an effective derivative Lagrangian to describe the theory. So that's how it works. Now, it turns out to be a fact that the leading term is not really interesting, but important to detect. That is the leading form of the Nambu-Goto, which is just the pi over L multiples in the level spacing. Interestingly enough, the first correction to that also seems to be universal. It's model independent. So when you take the exact Nambu-Goto solution and you extend it up to the first correction, it would agree with Joe's proposition and everybody else's in field theory. And the model dependence is in the next term, which is, of course, very hard to get. Now, here I will show you kind of a summary situation for the fixed NZ2. I have a similar one also for the closed string soliton with one unit of winding. The conclusions are very similar, but last night when I was looking at the transparencies, I realized that I was pushing the limit, so I didn't include it in this part. So what I am plotting here is the first four excitations, which are the blue dots, and I will explain to you what the curves are. That's very important. And then we try to compare. So you see here this red line. This red line is actually the first non-trivial correction to Nambu-Goto when you plot gaps. So I'm plotting gaps for excitations first, second, third, fourth. It starts with an N. There's a correction term. And everybody will agree on this correction term, I assert. But nobody knows how that should look like. Of course, Nambu-Goto predicts it. The prediction is totally wrong. You can see it from the data. You already see that also in QCD. So Nambu-Goto, in the fine structure, is not capable of describing what you have. There's a one way out that, well, maybe the ends are kind of messing up this stuff. But look at the scale here. We are moving out here to about 6 Fermi or so. Thank you. But only because I cut out the other half. So, I mean, you have here results out to about 10 Fermi for the spectrum. And now what we really would like to have is this. But if you look at the data, so the red one includes that guy, and the data may be asymptotical, not maybe, definitely tends towards it. But even at separations, at 4 Fermi or so, the data is quite different from it. That is, the solid line is just a fit to the data, including other terms, but just numerically. I told you I'm an experimentalist, right? So we know that, but the really interesting one is the viola, because that's what you get in leading order from quantum field theory. It's closer to the data than anything which is string-like. Now the reason for that is probably twofold. One, the field theory is, as we all know, and some of us still love, is hard to fool. It's a tough kind of mistress. So it knows about the ends, it describes the ends properly. More importantly, it knows about the Goldstone modes, but it also tells you how well the Goldstone modes are interacting via local derivative expansion and what deviations you have. So there is some indication that the interactions are not very well described here locally. And as I told you, you see similar features also in the string soliton spectrum, the analog string soliton spectrum we also have in Z2. Now, that was done at a given lattice spacing, which was a small one around 0.04, but you may wonder how small is small, you know, in Z2. Well, it's small enough, because we did a ton of simulations varying the lattice spacing, and the scaling curves are absolutely beautiful. That includes here four different lattice spacings. And, you know, it's a universal curve, so this is continuum physics. So forget your lattice hangover that it's not about the lattice. This is about the string. Another one here for n equals 2. Now, I also should point out that there's a similar Casimir paradox here. But the paradox is a lot more interesting in a way because you can try to deal with it. After all, you have the spectrum, you have a quantum field theory underlying, and I don't have time to spend on it here. If it comes up in any discussion, private or whatever, panel, Matt is planning to organize some discussion, I will be more than happy to talk about it. So here I just mentioned that you can study the Casimir energy situation. Actually, here we calculated how the vacuum energy density is distributed around the soliton. So in fact, that distribution you can integrate and then you get the full Casimir energy. So you also see here how the Casimir energy is distributed. So this is neat and I still don't fully understand it. So I have two slides to summarize. Undoubtedly, we see massless Goldstone modes. That, I emphasize again, is not a license to immediately substitute it with a local effective string theory, because you don't know how local the interactions are as those modes develop. But they are there, and they are interacting, and it's a very important issue. We definitely have a fine structure. The fine structure is accurate enough now in the Z2 situation that you can begin to really probe what the underlying physics is for this fine structure, rigidity, and possible other things. In QCD, we are not quite there, but the Z2 stage, I hope, convince you that this is now getting closer. And now in Z2, we did find massive excitations. I showed you some early, this pulsating bag, which develops into the massive breathing string modes. It's there, this whole part of the spectrum is there. And of course, the two modes interact. In addition, in Z2, we saw how we ought to understand the decay of an excited string into glue balls, which are the closed loops, right? Because when I ask some of you, give me this calculation, you know, the width of an excited string state bubbling up, you know, a closed string. Well, let's discuss it during this week. Now, in field theory, of course, you can do it. In field theory, what you see is a scattering process. You take a massive excitation in the bulk, you scatter on the ground state string, you see it getting excited. It's a crossover on the energy levels. And then it re-decays into the glue ball. So that's how you see the excited string state having a finite width, much harder in QCD. Then we have those breathing modes well studied. And of course, those things remain under question mark for QCD. But actually, it also remains under some question marks in the simple Z2. So I challenge everybody who wants to do QCD string theory connection, let's clean up the Z2 first. Let us nail down what kind of string is that. Now this may be, you know, you may want to rescue into ADS or something, and I cannot help that. So, but certainly to me as a mechanical engineer, it would be very important to know how you nail it down. So this becomes, you know, it's within reach. And this was just the summary of what I already pointed out several times, so I don't have to go through this again. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for this beautiful insight into experimental evidence for string theory. That we have some time for discussion.
You didn't study Z2 gauge model in three dimensions. You started with at finite temperature. Didn't you see what happens with your string when you heat it up?
It would be very interesting. No, we did not study it. So practically all the data we have or the results, the spectrum is at zero temperature. Of course, on the lattice, strictly speaking, unless you do a direct transformative calculation, nothing is really zero temperature. But just to give you an idea what it involves, you know, when I run some stuff in the Z2 model on say 200 by 200 lattice, okay? And then you look at the quark antiquark separation at 100. Then you use a time direction which is about say 1600. So it's very low temperature. And as you vary this temperature, you don't see any change. It would be very interesting also to push it to the transition region. We haven't done.
Would it be possible
There should be the confinement phase transition associated with percolation.
Yeah.
People think that it's the same mechanism as in a real, well, Young-Mills theory.
Yes.
Yeah, if you can see the string, well, just see it at zero temperature, it would indeed be interesting to see how this it smears out and so on.
Yes. Well, you know, I hope that more and more people will do this stuff. So it's there. The technology is not that hard. It's somewhat tricky, but it's not that hard.
What is Costellus Thallus about the roughening transition?
Why is it Costellus Thallus?
Right.
Well, it is because basically when you look at the Z-twin, the easing representation, through repeated mapping, you can easily map it into essentially a Sine-Gordon type behavior and an XY type behavior. And so when you look at the mappings, and they all should lead to the same universal behavior at the roughening point, you see directly in the other mapped versions. In terms of simulation, you see it. And if you do a strong coupling expansion and you try to padding it to that transition point, you also see that the only thing which matches it is Costellus Thallus. Now, of course, here I didn't show you the vortices. The analog of the vortices here are defects in the lattice. So when you look at the Wilson surface, as it is embedded in the bulk, but you just look at the structure of the Wilson surface, you begin to see more and more those defects on that surface, which ultimately will lead to this transition from the massive to this massless phase.
You talk mostly about baryonic, about bosonic string. Now people talk more and more about baryonic strings as well. In particular, Gerard Hoft had talked here a few weeks ago on instability of such a string.
Yes.
Any chance that such instability can be seen in lattice simulations?
Well, there are two issues here. There are two issues here, right? So think about it. One issue is what happens if I turn on the fermion loops. That's one issue. That is incredibly confusing and controversial. Suppose Mr. Lüscher is right, and the measured Casimir energy is the loop on God's finger in the 16th chapel. Now, in this case, you turn on the quark loops. This thing is not going to break at 0.5 Fermi. So are we still going to see something which is a string-like Casimir energy or not? We don't know the answer to it because we cannot do this kind of high-precision calculation there. Now, of course, as you pull, the string will break, and the lattice guys, whom I kind of hang out most of the time, did break the string in that sense in the last couple of years. But there is another question which I think intellectually is even more interesting or challenging. Think about Z2. What was the outcome of the original Polyakov loop analysis for Z2? That Z2 somehow is equivalent to two fermionic strings, each of them carrying one half of the conformal charge. That's the microscopic loop variables. And somehow this thing conspires to produce a bosonic string, which is your confining string, which you see with its spectrum. How will that emerge from the loop equation? How do the two fermionic strings transform themselves into the observed macroscopic string from the microscopy? That's what you guys are supposed to work out.
You mentioned that you were starting to see deviations from Nambu-Goto for the QCD string. So how large are these deviations, say, in comparison to the Z2 string case?
They are significant enough that we know that Nambu-Goto is not going to work well. It is not working for the fixed dense spectrum. There is a relatively cheap way out, saying, well, you know, there are end effects, and it's not just a boundary operator. Lüscher himself saw some deviations, and he totally misinterpreted it first in his first paper. He associated them with string boundary operators. Then later on, he published a paper where he invoked some of those space-time symmetries where he actually eliminated this possibility. So we know that the boundary terms are ugly, but when you do the string soliton, you still see the deviations. So therefore, I believe the signal from the spectrum is more that the Goldstone modes are there. They develop, say, on the string soliton, but their interaction is still non-local. So you cannot just describe it because what they exchange. After all, the way they interact in the field theory language is that they exchange stuff. And it's not massive enough on the string scale yet to approximate it with a local density. We tried, and I don't think the data is good enough yet to really, yes, but again, you know, I don't think it is conclusive to say anything.
Well, we're clearly going to have many more discussions on the data and on the theoretical aspects, so I'd like to thank Julius for a very interesting and enlightening talk, and that ends this part of the session. Let's thank Julius first again. Do the organizers have anything they want to say at this point? No? Okay, coffee break in the new patio, and we come back at 10 of.